From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Joni, a podcast series that tells the story of Joni Mitchell over the course of a year. My name is Andy, and I'll be your host throughout this audio journey. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I'd love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Joni. I'd also appreciate any positive reviews and feedback that you can leave. On this month's episode, we'll be taking a look at the experiences that would spark Joni Mitchell's evolution as an artist. As chronicled in an anonymous interview found in Sheila Weller's book, Girls Like Us, Joni Mitchell allegedly attempted suicide in the wake of her discovery of a cheating Jackson Browne. The story goes on to tell about David Geffen rushing her to the hospital. While Joni has denied this story, it is revealing that soon after the breakup with Jackson Browne, Joni would move in to David Geffen's house.
I came to stay with David Geffen as a guest and was kind of the woman who came to dinner. I ended up staying on for a while.
We were roommates. For me, it was a very heady time. You know, I had signed Bob Dylan and I was dating Cher. You know, it was very tumultuous and a lot of fun in the 70s.
Back in 1970, Joni had escaped her fame and sadness by traveling the world. In 72, she'd escaped to the Canadian wilderness. But in 73, Joni changed her approach. Instead of solitude and self-reflection, she stashed her hurt away in favor of the party life that entailed living with David Geffen.
I knew where David was going, and I could see that he loved that world. You could see he was cultivating a whole new group of people.
I had built the Roxy on Sunset Boulevard with a few other people. And opening night, Elmer Valentine comes in and he says to me, Cher is here, can she sit at your table? So I said, sure, absolutely. And she comes in and she sits down next to me and we were flirting with each other at the table.
The Roxy would serve as a distraction from Joni's melancholy, and an endless stream of movie stars and musicians would be partying there any given night. She would reflect on her fragile state at these all-night parties, trying to bury her pain in alcohol and drugs on the song People's Parties.
All the people at this party, they've got a lot of style. They've got stamps of many countries. They've got passport smiles. Some are friendly, some are cutting. Some are watching it from the wings. Some are standing in the center, giving a get something. And her eye paint's running down. She's got a rose in her teeth and a lampshade crown. One minute she's so happy, then she's crying on someone's knee, saying, laughing and crying, you know it's the same release. I told you when I met you I was crazy. Cry for a soul, beauty. Cry for Eddie in the corner thinking he's nobody, and Jack behind his joker, and Stone Cold Grace behind her fan. Me and my frightened silence, thinking I don't understand. I feel like I'm sleeping.
The Jack mentioned in that song? Well, that would be Jack Nicholson, of course. And he often tried to woo the young songstress, but Joni wasn't having it. One other famous actor would be more successful in his courting efforts.
How you? This here's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barron.
Clyde.
We robbed banks.
Warren Beatty's womanizing ways were no secret in 1973. But in the emotional condition Joni was in at that time, she didn't care. She'd had her fair share of serious relationships, and she was in need of a diversion. There also may have been a little revenge found within Joni's tryst with Beatty, since it was well known that he'd broken the heart of Carly Simon years earlier, the same woman who married James Taylor around that time. Simon's hit song, You're So Vain, has been rumored to be about Beatty, or possibly David Geffen. Whatever the case, Joni got the last laugh. It became clear to Beatty early in their relationship that Joni needed help that couldn't be found at the bottom of a bottle or lined up on a mirror. He suggested she visit German psychoanalyst Martin Grohan. Geffen had been given similar advice.
I'd always thought that if you have a lot of money, you'll be happy. And I certainly was not. I went to see a guy named Martin Grochan because Warren Beatty, who said that he was the therapist that all the therapists went to. I was telling him my whole story. And he said, you should go see Dr. So-and-so. And I said, well, I don't want to see Dr. So-and-so. I want to see you. He says, yeah, but I don't want to see you. I said, why not? He said, I'm too old. You're too crazy.
Joni's song Twisted would be a playful look at her sessions with Dr. Grochan.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not, don't know. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, when out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs, ands, or buts.
As evidenced by the lyrics, Joni found the whole experience to be a bit of a crapshoot. And eventually, Grochan would tell her in frustration, quote, "You have come to the wrong psychiatrist." She would also end her relationship with Beatty soon after it started. Reflecting on that time, she said, quote, "I was sad, trying to get something going in impossible situations. It's not James' fault. He's fucked up. And Jackson Brown, he's just a nasty bit of business. So to go from one to the other kind of scared me against going into another relationship. I knew the game Beatty was playing. He told Grochan that I was the only woman that beat him at his own game. And I said at that point, if I won something, what did I win? Psychiatry may not have been her thing, but during her time spent living within Geffen's never-ending party, she began to see value in the collective experience. At one of these all-nighters, she met John Gearin of the jazz fusion group the LA Express. The two hit it off over their shared love of Miles Davis, and soon after she saw them perform at a club called The Baked Potato. It was that night that she realized she needed the same communal spirit within her music. She would soon after ask Gearin and his band to join her in studio for her next album. Here's Graham Nash reflecting on what this experience must have been like for Joni.
Joni has always wanted to be part of the gang. As feminine as she is, she's always wanted to be one of the boys. And when she played with the LA Express, she probably just created her own little gang.
Joni was ready to shed the confessional songwriter label and explore new ways of expressing herself musically.
I shouldn't be stereotyped as a magic princess as I got earlier in my career, you know, the sort of twinkle, twinkle, little star kind of attitude. You know, I didn't like that feeling. And I think that the band will only show that there is another side to the music. I think it's a good expansion.
Henry Louis would return to the mixing boards, but everything else would change. While the Blue and For the Roses sessions had been intimate, often depressing experiences, the sessions that would result in the album Court and Spark would be lively and fun. Here's manager Elliot Roberts on the change in tone that took place in the studio.
She loved the camaraderie of all these guys who were great, great players and who recognized what a great guitar player she was. And the joy of just having a killer rhythm section, it was so much more fun.
It seems the LA Express unleashed a new edge to Joni's voice as she sang with a scorned vigor that was a far cry from the angelic lullabies of old. Here's musician and biographer Malcolm Arome reflecting on Joni's change in vocal approach.
Her image was the vulnerable blonde. And when she went with the band, there was something masculine about it. There was a certain power and confidence that was conveyed through the bass and the drums. and nobody ever heard her sing like this before.
Lyrically, much of Courtney Spark would also be a change of pace. Instead of shielding herself from the emptiness of Hollywood, she would shine a spotlight on the selfish and greedy nature of, as she called it in the title track, the city of fallen angels.
Love came to my door with a sleeping roll and a madman's soul. He thought for sure I'd seen him dancing up a river in the dark, looking for a woman to court and spark. He was playing on the sidewalk for passing change when something strange happened. Glory train passed through him, so he buried the coins he made in People's Park and went looking for a woman to court and spark. It seemed like he read my mind. He saw me mistrusting him and still acting kind. He saw how I worried sometimes. All the guilty people, he said, they've all seen the stain on their daily bread, on their Christian names. I cleared myself, I sacrificed my blues, and you could complete me, I'd complete you. His eyes were the color of the sand in the sea, and the more he talked to me, you know, the more he reached me. But I couldn't let go of L.A., city of the fallen angels.
The jazz musicians in L.A. Express were no stranger to odd chords, but when Joni presented them with her distinctive mix of augmented progressions, it took some getting used to.
But also, I mean, on Courtney Spark, I think you really had to, that was probably where you first had to translate your music to other musicians.
Well, I sang a lot.
Did they look at you funny when you started playing them those songs?
I sang a lot of the parts, mm-hmm. You know, so that one I really, because it was kind of as writ, you know, I sang the horn parts and then Tom transcribed them. Sometimes I left some of the voices in. So, you know, it was pretty much written. The guitar player I gave certain instructions to. Bass and drums took care of themselves because I found the right players.
As Joni was learning to get her mojo back in studio, her roommate, David Geffen, was going through his own downfall after being dumped by Cher.
It wasn't in the cards. She fell in love with Greg Allman. And the week that Cher and I broke up, there was a cover story in Esquire magazine which said, "Who is man enough for this woman?" And clearly I was not.
It was now Joni's turn to be there for Geffen, in need of an escape from the helter-skelter music business and his own sadness. The two friends would travel to Paris with the band's Robbie Robertson and his wife.
I was looking to show up for all these people, for all their problems, both personal and professional. You know, there is a point at which you feel like, who's showing up for me? When I got to the point that I really began to wonder about me in all of this, was the point at which I no longer wanted to do a lot of that. I went to Paris with Joni and with Robbie Robertson and his wife.
Joni and I were sightseeing and talking, and next thing I know, she wrote Free Man in Paris.
I was a free man in Paris. I felt unfettered and alive. There was nobody calling me up for favors, and no one's future to decide. You know I go back there tomorrow, but for the work I've taken on, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song.
While we were over there, he didn't have a worry in the world. He wasn't on the phone, calling and worrying about stuff. I think that she saw his liberation, and it inspired her.
I deal in dreamers and telephone screamers. Lately I wonder what I'd do it for. If I had my way, I'd just walk through those doors and
I felt exposed. I was embarrassed about it because it was revealing in a way that I was not comfortable with.
I don't know. I saw a certain amount of pride in his eyes, you know. I'd be proud too.
Free Man in Paris would reach number 22 on the Billboard charts, but for the first time, David Geffen was dismayed by being exposed by the lyrics, specifically the line, quote, "Find that very good friend of mine," which hinted toward Geffen's closeted homosexual feelings that as a close friend, Joni had been privy to.
One of the things that I was uncomfortable with was being gay. Growing up in the 40s and the 50s, being gay was a really bad thing in the minds of people that I lived with. That issue was a struggle for years and years and years.
I guess I am, in this sense, a true artist, in that I feel that it's better to sacrifice myself to the song than someone else. You know, I can forgive myself for revealing myself, whereas sometimes very simple portraits that I don't think are... Like, David Geffen had a hard time with Free Man in Paris for a long time. He was offended by it initially, and yet it doesn't reveal anything unattractive about him. We went to the Cannes Film Festival one time, and it was his first time in Paris, and after we returned, David and I were roommates at that time, you know. I can remember him lamenting, "Oh, I want to go back to Paris, I want to go back to Paris," and he was kind of drowning in business responsibility. That's how I recall it. And the song contains a lot of his feelings in his own words at that time. You know, I kind of scribed them. And initially, he didn't really want to be, not that I put his name on it, everybody knows it now because the press always ferrets these things out, but...
Because you were dealing with sexuality and
well, I don't,
one's
was it? Is there a sexuality that's, I don't know, it just seems to me like a longing to be back, you know, on the Champs-Élysées, you know, that it became a symbol, I think, of freedom as opposed to business responsibility.
Upon release, Court and Spark would be a massive success. Within 2 months of its release, it would be number 2 on the Billboard charts, the highest charting Mitchell album in her career. The album would go on to sell 2 million copies in its first year and eventually gain double platinum status. The song "Help Me" would be Joni's only career top 10 single performed by her.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love too fast. It's got me hoping for the future and worrying about the past. 'Cause I've seen some hot, hot places come down to smoke and ash. Like we love our freedom.
Courtney Spark would be heralded by music critics. John Landau of Rolling Stone magazine would say, "The special beauty of Courtney Spark is that it forces us to both cry and laugh, and that it does so with such infinite grace." The album would go on to be named Album of the Year by the Village Voice, and in 2003, Rolling Stone would rank it 111 on its list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. Despite the inclusion of Free Man in Paris, Geffen and his newly formed Asylum Records relished in the album's success.
Courtney Spark was a great achievement for Joni. It catapulted her into the forefront of recording stars. It was a triumph.
Reaching number 2 on the charts is very different than reaching number 11, as she had done with For the Roses. Suddenly, her name recognition would go beyond the young people and become a household name. To capitalize on the album's success, Joni and the LA Express would go on a whirlwind 75-date tour that would span the entirety of 1974. This sounds like it would be torture for the singer-songwriter who had, on past tours, despised the experience of performing in front of big crowds. But with the LA Express backing her up, Joni basked in the experience.
Now being on the stage with a group of people, I can go back and I can say, weren't we great if we were, or ooh, weren't we awful if we were? So it's not such a lonely thing.
On July 28th, Joni and her band would perform in St. Paul, Minnesota at the Civic Arena, and a 15-year-old boy in the audience by the name of Prince Rogers Nelson would be forever changed. He would go on to be known as the artist Prince.
When he was, I think, 15, he was very young anyway, I played Minneapolis, and I remember him because he has those distinctive eyes, they're like a puffin, you know, or like Egyptian wall paintings, and he sat to the left of me in the front row with his head kind of cocked at me like a puffin bird. And I played a lot of my set to him, you know. Very young, impressionable musician, so I guess that night meant something to him.
Prince would go on to refer to Joni as a major influence. In the liner notes for his 1980 album Dirty Minds, he would thank God, Joni, and the fans. The cover to the 1983 album Controversy would feature newspaper headlines, one of which that simply said, "Joni" in all caps. He's even said she influenced his use of color and sound, so it could be argued that there would be no Purple Rain without Joni's blue. In his early days as a performer, he would often perform Joni classics, including Case of You.
You're in my blood, like only mine, so baby, so baby, so, so, so sweet, and I could drink a case of you, ooh, darling, oh yeah, yeah, and I still be on my feet, and I still be on my, still be on my feet, I still, yeah, 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 yeah.
After the epic cross-country tour, Joni would release the live album Miles of Isles, recorded during a two-night run at the Berkeley Community Theater. The collection of jazzy reinterpretations of Joni classics would reach number 2 on the Billboard charts, a rare mark for a live album.
Hey, Bama, Bama.
While on the road with the band, Joni would spark a relationship with drummer John Gearon. The two were inseparable on the road, often sharing a hotel room and even collaborating on music together, a rarity for the often guarded songwriter. Late at night, the two would work on the parts for what would be the title track on her next album, The Hissing of Summer Lawns.
Thank you.
you couldn't tell by that track, Joni was ready to dive headfirst into jazz after dipping her toes in on Court and Spark. When she returned to the studio in 1975, Joni would give the members of her studio band freedom to explore their own parts. This is a shocking evolution for an artist who wouldn't even trust a producer to touch her music. On The Hissing of Summer Lawns, Joni was letting down her guard.
Then on Hissing, I cut my players a lot of slack, and it went more towards jazz. They began to use the colors of their background more.
Lyrically, the album would be very different from her confessional work, instead opting to tell third-person narratives from a wide spectrum of interesting characters. Songwriter Elvis Costello has cited the album as having a major impact on his own approach to storytelling and music. Coming off of her success on Court and Spark, Asylum Records was looking for another hit. On one hand, Hissing of Summer Lawns would be a success on the Billboard charts, reaching number 4, her third highest to this day. However, the lyrics of pimps, jungles, and reverse gender mythology, in combination with the abrupt change in her sound, all of it would have an impact on the sales of albums to come. One listen to The Jungle Line, my personal favorite on the album, and it's clear we are not in Saskatoon anymore.
Rousseau walks on trumpet pegs, so fire is to the heart of all the gems. Through eye bars and girders, through wires and pipes, the mathematic circuits of the modern night. Through huts, through Harlem, through jails and gospel pews, through the class on Park and the trash on Vine, through Europe and the deep, deep heart of Dixie Blue, through savage progress cuts the jungle line.
Critics would not be kind to the album. Stephen Holden of Rolling Stone would write, "The Hissing of Summer Lawns offers substantial literature set to unsubstantial music." And the Detroit Press would write, "Mitchell takes a tone that is smug, sometimes so smug that it's downright irritating."
A lot of people didn't dig that, you know. I was going over the edges of the box I was supposed to be in, you know.
As with most Joni Mitchell albums, appreciation for The Hissing of Summer Lawns has grown with time. When the album was reissued in 2016, Pitchfork Media would give the album a 10 out of 10. It would also be included in Robert Dimey's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. But back in 1975, Joni had thrown many of her fans for a loop. After an album like Hissing of Summer Lawns, most artists would return to what had gained them their fan base as a sign of reassurance. But Joni wasn't concerned with taking her foot off the pedal and waiting for the masses to catch up.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe. A defector from the petty wars. Until love sucks me back that way.
Joni goes deeper into her experimentations in music on the next Year of the Joni. If you enjoyed today's episode and don't want to wait another month for the next installment, go check out the other two seasons of the Year of the podcast series. For the David Bowie story, search Year of the Bowie, and the Neil Young story is Year of the Neil. Both podcasts are available on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also check out my monthly podcast entitled BDWPS Podcast, where I play some of my favorite new music coming from the underground. If you are interested in exploring any of the interviews or songs played on this month's episode, a works cited list can be found on BDWPS.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a month.